This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 102.7 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, women are transforming and diversifying the workforce in South Africa like never before. They're becoming pillars of hope and inspiring young girls across the country to enter industries that they never thought possible even a few years ago. And as the country celebrates Women's Month, we salute some extraordinary South African women who are redefining and disrupting various industries once thought to be male-dominated. Certainly encouraging for me personally as a father of two beautiful, inquisitive young girls that they will step into a world where we might perhaps not even have to address things like glass ceilings in 20 years' time. Let's introduce tonight's panel. First up, Sabine Dalomo, who's the Chief Executive Officer for Siemens Southern and Eastern Africa and President of the German South Africa Business Chamber. Sabine, great to chat to you again.
Hi, Michael. Great to hear you.
Also on the line, we've got the Chief Financial Officer of the Johannesburg Securities Exchange, Artie Takodin. Artie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michael. Good to chat to you.
And we've invited Leila Ebrahimi, who's a PwC People and Organization Associate Director, to explore the gender gap and other issues on gender in South Africa to make up our trio on the panel tonight. Leila, good evening.
Good evening, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Now, Sabine, you're the CEO of the local subsidiary of the largest industrial manufacturing company in Europe, and certainly a preserve that was once only for men. Manufacturing certainly opened up to women. How did you come to head up Siemens in South Africa? Because I know you're not an engineer. You're more of a numbers person.
Yes. So I have a financial background, and I think, you know, when you like what you do and you're good in it and you have a broader view on what the business is about, always look beyond your job you're currently in, you know, understand on how the company works, how things come together, then it's a natural move, because eventually, you know, when you run an operation on the level where I'm currently active, it is not necessarily so much of an importance of where your original destination is from, but rather really understanding the business dynamics to also make sure that you deal with interests, particular shareholders' interests and the likes. And so as the vacancy came up, I obviously proved myself and some of my superiors were of the opinion I'm the right person. And when they asked me, I said, yes, I will do it.
Well, I mean, that's certainly the characteristic of an ambitious leader, someone who is willing to put themselves forward for very challenging roles. And certainly here in sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of opportunity, a lot of challenges as well. But you've really been inside the Siemens framework and architecture and in the belly of the organization for the bulk of your career, for over 25 years now. How important has it been to your career progression to be inside one organization? Have you had mentors along the way that have played a key role in helping you progress through your career?
Yes, sir, but I think in my early years they didn't have anything like mentors. So I had the luck that in the early years of my business life, I had a few female managers which really, you know, shared a lot of their insights on how they survived. I mean, this is now 25 years backwards in a much more male-dominated environment, and you know how they also make sure that as a woman, you don't lose your aspect of being a woman because you are different and you should not try. And that was one wisdom one of my early managers gave me. Don't try to be a man, but just rather, you know, try who you are, and that will make you successful, because then people know you and you don't have to fake it. Yeah. I mean, that gives you, your personality, which then makes people well more interested as well in what you have to say than rather if you have a show which you pull off every single day you go to work. And I must say that was quite helpful. But you know, within Siemens, also I have worked my whole working life with that company, but I had the pleasure to move around in the company. I worked in the US in one of my early years in Silicon Valley at that time, and I thought, well, this is a great place to work. The Americans, they all know how business works. And I was actually quite a bit disappointed the way and how they operate their business affairs. I was quite happy to be back in Germany afterwards again.
Why were you disappointed? You can't just gloss over that and wholly skip along.
Because I thought, you know, when I was much younger, and I thought the Americans have all the wisdom on how business works, on how they run their operation, how they communicate with each other. And it didn't happen. It was very much an isolated cubicle style, you know, where everybody does their own thing, but they hardly communicate with each other about business besides they go to the coffee stand and talk of sports or the family. And I thought that was just not how Germans work. We communicate in business all the time. So I was a bit disappointed, and as I said, I was quite happy being back in Germany. But I worked then as well in various areas in the German organization, really understanding on how our company comes together from strategy, from figures. And yeah, lastly, before I came to South Africa, I was for more than 3 years in China.
In Shanghai?
In a time in Shanghai, yeah. And yeah, so I learned that part of the continent. I must say, I do like to work in South Africa because I think the South Africans and also the African economies, also it's not always easy, but you know, they really make an effort in their own means to make it better. So I enjoy it very much.
And you're a permanent South African resident now. I believe you arrived in 2004, but you are now a permanent South African resident.
Yes, so I met my husband, and then I decided it's good to come to the place where he resides, so I came to South Africa.
And we'll come back to some of those lessons that you learnt along the way, particularly in Shanghai. I'm very curious, considering the level of involvement that we're seeing in China and manufacturing across the African continent. Artie, I want to move on to your career story, which is fascinating as well. You've been Chief Financial Officer at the JSE since 2013. You're a CA by training, so a natural fit. But at the time of your appointment, you're also, I believe, the youngest CFO of a listed company at the tender age of 32. So you had almost a sort of dual pressure of your age and also being a woman in a very male-dominated world of finance. How did that sit on your shoulders at the time? Is it something that you were even acutely aware of?
The point, Michael, I think that I always say to people, when I engage with predominantly people who don't know me in an industry or in the organization that I deal with, I am confronted with one of any four biases. And if I were to, you know, get caught up in just being involved in that bias and the spiral that it can send you into, then I wouldn't be as productive as I'd like to be or that I am. So how I do is I largely, you know, don't even play that game. So for me, this has been largely the recipe for success, is just to, you know, put your head down and play your own game. Don't subject yourself to others and other rules, and just prove competence. And as soon as one does prove competence, then all biases, no matter what it is, age bias, gender bias, racial bias, just gets thrown out the window. So I don't know anybody who would hold any bias against somebody who proves that they are, you know, merit-based and competent.
Isn't that a wonderful example of what we should be striving for in South Africa in order to be this prosperous nation, is for us to really instill and inculcate that desire to strive to be the best, to put merit above everything else. Does business run in your family blood?
Hard work does. I'm not sure about business. Well, maybe it does, because to be honest, I kind of accidentally stumbled into becoming a CA.
So I wanted to open my own business and run my own restaurant when I was fresh out of high school at 17. And I wrongly assumed that one needs capital in order to start a business. Obviously, the notion of startups completely challenges that. And I thought, oh, you know, I can't. I need to go have get a secure traditional job. Mm. And my mom said to me, look, she was working at a factory at the time, and she said, there's this group of people who speak very well. They're very well dressed, and everybody's afraid of them. They're called the auditors. So you need to apply at the audit firm.
Well, we don't want to be demeaning to the profession, but I've heard more than one person refer to them as frauditors with all of the accounting scandals we're seeing on the JSE at the moment. I say that in jest. It is still probably the most sought-after qualification in the country. Do you think, considering that you once had entrepreneurial ambitions and aspirations, that you might end up in the field of entrepreneurship with the business of your own at some stage?
I think an entrepreneurial spirit is something that that if you're not born with, it does develop over time as you interact and collect a significant amount of gems that I've been lucky to, similar to what I've been lucky to collect in my career. And so, yeah, I mean, I would be open to that. I think that having that CA qualification, which I'm incredibly proud of and I stand by, is only an asset in that regard.
Absolutely, and it's incumbent upon CAs with integrity such as yourselves to really stamp out those who are unfortunately giving the industry a bit of a bad name. It is always the very small minority that tarnish the majority with that brush. I don't want to digress.
Those things happen in most professions.
Absolutely, yeah. As with journalists, yeah. As not with exclusive. All professions, Artie. Now, in terms of your career, at once again the very tender age of 20, you had your degree in hand. You started then working at the South African Bureau of Standards. You were a provisional financial manager and I believe helped to drive the then Parastatal through its big transformation. You helped contribute to the historic event of the SABS making a profit for the first time in 50 years. No small feat in the world of state-owned companies. What did that period teach you?
So at 23, I had passed my board exam, so I was a CA, and what it taught me was that innovation is something that does, and thinking differently, innovation and thinking differently holds one in good stead in an organization that is faced with challenges like this one was. I also learned that culture was incredibly important to me. So on the back of that, I moved into the multinational space. And I'd like to say I grew up in my corporate career in the multinational, predominantly American space. And that was one incredible journey in terms of it being open to diversity, level playing field. And if you had talent, then you rose in the multinational environment because you work in virtual teams. Nobody really cares what you look like, or where you come from. And because you're using technology to interact with your teams that are across the world. And performance just stood out when you're in such a large organization of over 120,000 individuals.
Was that at HP under the wings of Gua Fuxia?
That's it. At HP, I'd like to say I grew up there. And that culture, being an enormous organization headcount-wise, an enormous organization revenue-wise, and geographic reach, it had a very strong culture that just kind of got into your blood, Mm-hmm. And talent was recognized, and not in monetary terms, it was recognized in more work terms and more exposure. So that was fabulous. In a multinational, if you put your hand up, they'll just take you through their talent pipeline. And I went through that sausage machine there and afterwards at the next one.
So, How, yep. On that point, how important, and I asked Sabine as well, is mentorship to help young talent grow and particularly break glass ceilings? Is it more just about the opportunity being there in a large multinational organization and it's incumbent upon you to spot the opportunity and grab it and run with it? Or is it a two-way street? Do you need someone to really put a hand down to lift you up from the thundering herd, so to speak?
You know, Michael, my mind's slightly different. I had no idea of this concept of sponsorship or mentorship through my career, especially in my early years. I was not lucky enough to have someone take me under their wings necessarily. I had incredibly strong leaders who recognized talent and just, were pro-development. And as long as you put in the hard work, they exposed me and had development conversations with me. My philosophy along the lines of talent and development is you don't present your body to your leaders and say, here's my body, develop me. You know, you drive your own development in your journey through your career, and you collect as many of those, as I said earlier, gems along the way. You're really the master of your own destiny. So I with these incredible leaders who, on reflection, if I look at my 20-year-old self, the luck involved was that I was surrounded by people who recognized talent and did something about it.
Yeah, I've had it put to me that one does need a certain amount of luck, a return on luck, the same way you have a return on investment. But you also need to be able to spot that luck and have the work ethic, as you spoke about, and the ability to roll up your sleeves and really grab the opportunity and run with it. Leaders, it is so interesting to hear you say that, are so important there. And then you come back home. So now you've been in a large multinational, global, 100,000 employees. Now you come back home to the little old JSE, and I say that with all due respect, but a much smaller operation. What was that transition like?
So you skipped a step in between with Johnson Controls International, where I looked after Middle East and Africa, because I had this goal that if I'm in the CA profession, I may as well max out in the corporate space. So by 30, I wanted to be FD. I was fortunate enough to do that by 29 at Controls. And again, 16 times the size in headcount and revenue terms at the JSE. But when Nikki called me from Johnson Controls International, and that's one of the elements I think that's attractive when you want to be led by admirable individuals. So Nikki called me, and I took the call seriously. I was on maternity leave at the time. And you know, she mapped out the transformation of the JSE for me in terms of, you know, her journey as a CEO. It was incredibly attractive for me. She recognized different ways of thinking, and she actually wanted a CFO that was just very different in thinking terms. And I saw this as an opportunity to serve my country in the corporate space. And I feel as though I had all this multinational talent and really was not part of South Africa in a meaningful enough way. And that was part of the attraction. So it was Nikki's leadership and also just being able to be part of a critical component of corporate South Africa.
And as a CFO in South Africa, I mean, you've obviously got to strike this balance between the transactional and the business side of your roles, and you partner very often with the business CEO as a CFO in a South African entity. Many of your larger multinationals outsource some of that stuff. Does that mean CEOs and CFOs work in tandem and partnership? And I ask that because we obviously know Nikki Newton-King has done an admirable job but has announced that her tenure has come to an end. Does that mean that you've almost got to start questioning whether or not you should look for another role, or are you committed to the JSE?
I'm excited about the next journey in the business of the JSE with under the new leadership. So I'm incredibly supportive of the new CEO and where we can take this business to. So I'm actually thinking in terms of the next cycle for the JSE. As much as it's incredibly sad to leave, say goodbye to such an inspirational leader like Nikki, but certainly excited about Leila's new incoming CEO-ship.
Layla, and this is not the same Layla, Layla of PwC, mm-hmm. I'd like to bring you in here because you just released a very interesting report on practices and remuneration trends, and it explores the gender gap, and a lot of the issues around gender in South Africa relate to remuneration, but they also relate to representation. And as we know, there are no female CEOs in the top 40 at the moment. We've got one CEO designate at Bidvest, Mpumi Madisa, but it is an indictment. What do you see as some of the root causes of this?
Hi, Michael. So it's really hard to actually determine what the root causes are. And more our research is just showing there's just a lack of data available. And that's the main thing we're driving for. We need transparency. We need more disclosure. We need people to start talking about the issues. We need, you know, more reporting on the issues to actually be able to properly analyze what the reasons are. But if I had to make an educated guess, I would say that the root causes are linked to things like recruitment policies, succession policies, and making, you know, not making sure that those are formally put in place and you have an adequate number of females represented on, for example, shortlists for candidates or in the succession, making sure that your females are represented in that succession plan. And then you get to issues such as flexibility. You know, if you're going to have females within the workplace and traditionally the females are the ones looking after the children where they are mothers, we need to make sure that there's flexibility, adequate flexibility in place and support structures that support those working mothers. You know, that's something that PwC does quite well, so I can, you know, see quite closely to that, making sure that if somebody needs to go home to fetch their kid, they can do that and it's not going to jeopardize their career.
That's very important. And Artie, I mean, you mentioned that at Johnson you were on maternity leave when Nikki invited you to come back. So obviously there were allowances made for your particular family circumstances. And one can't stress that enough, that life happens and you want to work inside an organization that has a culture and respect for your family life as much as your work output.
Exactly right.
Just on to another issue in the report, Layla, and it is very noticeable on the CFO front. So no female CEOs in the top 40. 96.6% of all CEOs in the JSE are male. 87.2% of CFOs are male. And 91% of executive directors are male. I mean, once again, as much as we talk about the issue of diversity and diversity being not only invited to the ball but asked to dance as well, there are real benefits that we shouldn't even have to discuss of having another set of eyes and a different EQ in a business around a boardroom table to apply to any particular strategy or set of circumstances. Why are we not seeing the representation numbers improve? What are the questions that businesses are not asking themselves that perhaps they could?
Absolutely, Michael. I think, you know, diversity, not just in terms of gender, but diversity on a whole is undisputable. It doesn't do us any you know, favors to talk about it because everybody knows or should know by now what the benefits of diversity are. So what are the questions we should be asking ourselves? We really, as I said before, we need to be looking at whether we are walking the talk. And I think, you know, within South Africa, we do have a lack of regulation or legislation that's actually dealing with this. Obviously, you know, we have the diversity policy that's coming in from the JSE, which is you know, going some way to actually making sure people are held accountable. But, you know, that's where the dirty word, if I can put it that way, of quotas starts coming in. And people start asking the question, do we need to be putting quotas in there? And does that do more damage than it does good? Or is it something we need to actively consider? And what, you know, legislative or regulatory intervention do we need here? And, you know, we're a big fan of transparency. So we always say, you know, let the sunlight shine on it. Let's actually see what the figures are looking like, not just in terms of the gender, as you say, quite rightly, representation as well. Mm. So let's also just get the information out there and let's actually be able to analyze it and see what are the reasons for this, because it's so hard to say. We don't know. We don't have access to the information to say, well, you know, behind every CEO, there's a successor. There's a successor being trained up there. Or if you're going external and you're looking for a CEO, what are your processes in terms of recruitment? Are you making sure that there are females there? We don't know whether there aren't females. I mean, it's very unlikely. Or whether the processes are not in place to make sure that those biases, I mean, Artie made the point just now about conscious biases. I'd like to think that those don't exist, but definitely unconscious bias. Are we, you know, putting factors in place that actually mitigate those unconscious biases in, for example, the recruitment process?
Sabine, how do you approach it inside Siemens? Are you very focused and conscious about perhaps addressing some of those unconscious biases in your HR and hiring and succession planning?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we actively embrace certain trainings which deal with that unconscious bias, because, I mean, some of the decisions there are just, you know, coming at a convenience. And we train all our recruiters, but also our managers for that, with various level of interaction. But, you know, I mean, one of the biggest challenges you have is that as higher you get up the ladder, and that's from my experience, one reason why you see fewer women is because you do need to tap into the network, yeah? And men are traditionally, you know, mates. They have time to network all the time. You know, their life is about network. If you play golf or if you do some surfing, you spend 3 hours networking with individuals, which as a woman, if you have kids and you have to be at home and they're sick, you can't do that. Yeah. So just because certain things are sometimes not in your favor, it takes a hard toll on your private life, really, to make these connections. And I must say, and then coming back to South Africa, with the Employment Equity Act and with all the governmental aspects, it is much easier in South Africa to have that network built up than anywhere else. Like, for instance, in Germany, it's not that easy than it is in South Africa.
Sabine, I've got to stop you there. We have run out of time. Very interesting final point. Sabine Dalomo, CEO for Siemens Southern and Eastern Africa. Thank you so much as well to JSE CFO Arti Takodin and Lila Ibrahimi of PwC. That's a wrap from the team tonight. Sylvia A is in the Jazz Lounge in Cape Town. And then Gauteng, Carolyn Stain is up next with the smoothest classics on Winding Down. Good night.